Hi guys, and welcome to Design Indaba 2020 Day 2 Roundup. Welcome to the Resource Cast's fourth episode, I believe. We're sitting with Lucas van Vieren again and Zay Joseph. We are going to chat a little bit about what we've seen today on Day 2. There were 12 presentations today, and I think rather than go through all 12 of them, doing a pros and cons, especially difficult with some of the more visual artists, graphic designers, we're rather going to talk about kind of a couple of concepts and ideas that popped out to us over the last 2 days. There were a couple of great standout presentations. All of them were good, but a couple of great ones that we really want to chat about. In fact, especially one in particular that we felt deserved a little bit more approbation than it actually got on the day.
Approbation, big word.
Big word, running out the top shelf words here. So, Well, who we're talking about here, if you want to go onto the Design Indaba website or their social media accounts and have a look at their presentations or some snippets from them, Manu Prakash spoke about creating, spreading science across the world in a low-cost way, essentially shoestring budget science. And the work he did, we feel, is extremely impactful, but didn't quite get the response for that someone like Robert Wong from Google did. So why don't you guys start us off on? Let's talk a little bit about Robert first and then talk about Manu.
So Robert, full disclosure, Robert had me in tears. Like, literally, I was crying. I had to ask my girlfriend to give me a tissue.
I noticed that. I was close. I think the whole place.
The story about the dad got me. So and John put it in a good way, that he's the pitch man for Google. So if Google has a product, they figure out a design way or a communication way of getting that product across. But the trick is to get the technical thing across and the technical benefits in an emotional way. So just one of the stories that he did with the dad was that with Google just opening an email account and start emailing yourself the story about having a kid.
So emailing his daughter. Yes. He opened an account for his daughter and emailed her throughout her life.
And it was it's getting me again. And it starts as, today you were born. Hi. And then it'd be the next day, today's your first birthday. The charm and all the stuff coming through in that messaging was just beautiful. And all it was talking about emailing, really, and having an email.
And
Google
worked
account.
In a number of Google products, yes, in terms of uploading videos to YouTube. Here's where you were. I think it was, here's your first house, and they used Street View, link to that in the email so could see her first home.
It connects with everyone.
But it's told in a beautiful way, absolutely.
It connects with everyone.
But the products were seamlessly worked into it.
Yeah.
And then there was another, the other one where a guy it starts with searching travel to go to Paris. So it's about, tell me more about Paris, and then they'll search
Paris. Taking someone.
Tickets, and then tickets off for sale. And started with the idea that you can book tickets through Google.
Yeah, and track your flight.
The functionality
that he talked about,
but the emotion that happens with it's a guy who goes to Paris, meets a girl, or tries to talk to her. So it's Google Translate work,
flirting in French,
and all these products that they have. And then in the end, he actually then starts researching,
moves to Paris, gets a job, has a baby,
baby. And I loved his response to it, that it's a romantic story of a guy who does end up with the woman having a baby. And then the comment under the video was, it's just going so well until he had a baby.
Yeah.
And I thought that was such a, because it went from this charming story to then showing how interactive the products really are, again, with the real world example.
Personal and connection.
Yes. And also his presentation was done theatrically, because we're at the Artscape, so they used the stage and all those things, and it was
spotlights with props, him moving from space
to
space.
It wasn't his first time.
Not his first time on it remotely.
He's presented a couple of those videos before at Design Dub.
Yeah,
he's kind of a perennial favorite here, and everyone looks forward to his presentation. And
got a standing ovation.
Got a standing ovation. I mean, I think even the Dutch presenter, the MC, who is amazingly funny, and a lot of that humor is based on him being just a little bit of a dickhead, he was in tears as well.
Yes.
So
and he's a great salesman.
Fantastic. I think Robert's next talk and his next presentation should be on how to do a presentation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely.
we did it so well.
Yeah.
He could sell anything. I think he could sell anything.
Yeah. So, and then put him in contrast with the
Manu Prakash.
Manu Prakash, which, and I love the word that he set it up. He said frugal science.
Right.
No brand.
No brand.
No brand.
Just the work that they were doing.
Problem and solving it.
That's it. And well, not just solving it, economically and efficiently.
Efficiently, yeah.
And probably decimating that problem in its own way.
Mm.
Just to set it up. So
Can I set him up with bio?
Of course, go for it.
So physical biologist and MacArthur fellow Manu Prakash sets out to democratize science, believing that even those in low-resource environments should be able to explore and experiment. Prakash designs devices that empower frugal science.
It's an awesome setup. I just want to do a proviso before we go into this Design Indaba. I every year step into this trap and where I play the comparison game, where I go, that speaker was better than that speaker. And it's not about who's better or not. It's about the content and their intention and all the stuff that comes with it, and there's a theme with the event itself as well. So, but you naturally do that.
Of course.
And the thing that frustrated me with Manu was the things that get a standing ovation was usually the audience getting swept up in the moment with the emotion that came with it. So one of the first things Manu showed us was the problem that some countries and villages and things like that in Africa and India in rural areas don't have electricity. So one of the anecdotes that he shared, one of the first ones, was that he went to this clinic or a research facility and they had a centrifuge, and the centrifuge was being used as a doorstop. And he said, but this is an expensive piece of equipment. And they said, like, yeah, but we don't have electricity, so at least now it's being useful as a doorstop.
That's as useful as it gets.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So at the moment, that's what I can do with it. And that got them thinking. So the solution to the problem of centrifuge was it needed to spin at a hell of a rate. So it was actually a piece of ancient technology, and it was the button and string toy.
Mm.
Now, it's basically a button with string wrapped in a helix, I suppose, in a loop.
Disc.
And you pull it, and it just spins the little button, and it goes at incredible speeds. And he actually quizzed us and said, how many RPMs do you think this gets?
Mm. And the audience guessed around 50,000.
He started it because his first idea, I think, started with a yo-yo, because he was looking for human power, something small, something you can put in your pocket, something that's easy to manufacture, and human power and spin. The yo-yo came up.
4,000 RPMs or something?
Yeah, it was like the world record or something was 10?
Oh, really? Okay.
Maybe? I think
he broke it with 10.
I think,
but that button and string tool got them up to 110,000 RPMs.
That's
and then you put a bit of blood in that. I mean, you jury-rig a little centrifuge out of that.
Put a blood in it.
Not on the button.
The simplicity.
And then spin it off.
The simplicity of the mechanism.
Yeah.
I think was
ancient toy.
Yeah. So what they did is they created a way of then having a disc with a vial of blood in it, and you can start separating the plasmids in order to do the research properly. Mm. And then you can put that under a microscope and keep going, and you can figure out if people what level of malaria they're at. It made that so much easier. And it was so when he finished saying that, and everybody was just dead quiet.
Yeah.
And he went on to his next project.
Because it was the spotlight.
And I was like, that should have been
a standing ovation right there.
That's a Nobel Peace Prize thing. That should have been a standing ovation right there. But the salesmanship wasn't the same. So I wish Google
Robert's guys.
That Robert had done that. Absolutely.
It'd be like done.
Yeah. Look, if anyone from Design and Dobbs is listening, please ask Robert Wong to do a video for Manu Prakash telling people what he's doing, because the impact in malaria-ridden areas is massive.
And yesterday we spoke about it with Baz. What's his surname again?
Baz Timmer's,
and he again had a great initiative to make sleeping bags for people. That's a full body
homeless,
body sleeping bag for homeless people to not freeze to death.
The shelter suit.
Yeah, it's a great initiative, but the scale of it bugged me. And this was just a
at 600 rand a unit.
Exactly.
Manu's working in cents here.
Yes. And so that comparison game happened naturally now. What we were trying to get at was a real world solution for a real world problem. And I also just wanted to say, it's a third world solution to a third world problem.
Right.
Where people just don't have access to certain technologies. It's a proper, real thing, tangibly, that you can take out and scale and do whatever you need to. And I can just keep singing his praises. And he had like 3 or 4 different projects like that.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the other projects. One was a solution to, you know, a power telescope, which when you lack electricity is a huge problem. So they developed spectrometry. I hate that word. It is literally the most difficult word to say for me. But essentially stealing an idea from astronomy, using a spectrometer instead of a visual microscope to look at blood samples in high speed, powered by a cell phone battery charging pack that could work even when the power was out, scanning thousands of samples and getting diagnosis in 5 to 10 minutes.
It's completely autonomous.
For the listeners out there that don't understand, this technique was used in astrology to see things that
astrology.
Human eye.
Astronomy. For the listeners who don't understand, astronomy. Yeah.
Astronomy. I was so careful not to get it confused and then I hit the wrong one. For the Pisces out there.
So he's doing frugal homeopathy, which is easy because you just don't give anyone anything and they get better.
Astronomy. Yeah, so for him looking for people looking at the sky, not for signs, but for science, the human eye, there's certain waves that you can't see. So this method allows you to see more. So they use this technique on the microscope in order to see things a lot quicker, to identify certain bacteria.
Sure.
Yeah.
And it, because they, if you compare the diagnostics that can do within minutes versus one guy with a microscope that doesn't have electricity all day, that took it down from 8 hours a day that it usually takes to find something to 5 to 10 minutes.
Sure.
Standing ovation just for that.
Yeah,
it should be getting that.
And the other two main projects he talked about basically involved citizen scientists. So decentralizing science and getting thousands and thousands and thousands of people to contribute to the data and the research instead of centralizing it with highly expensive equipment and well, because simply the training is lacking. There aren't enough scientists to do the research. So I think the first one was tracking ocean plastic, and the second one was the foldoscope.
I was just going to add that he showed the map, and the map showed where there were certain scientists, and he spoke about there was like 575 scientists spread around this area collecting data.
In Africa.
And he said there was more people in the room than they are spread out. And he's the man's brain. Him thinking, you know what, rather than trying to mass produce scientists, which takes a long time, why don't we reduce the science for the masses? So this is the community that popped up with the microscope, because mm-hmm. it can see that you make it cheaper rather than this big microscope that takes scientists to actually operate and not actually work to work the thing. Rather than make the device smaller, and it's easier for anybody to use, kids, parents.
I think
it's great.
It was $1 for a microscope. Yeah. That's what they got it down. Bill Gates and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation tweeted about that, about the microscope.
Question mark? $1?
$1 origami microscope.
Yeah.
And you can look it up, the foldoscope. I believe it is available as a, you know, you can actually order them. And it is a fascinating little toy. I mean, you can, not a toy, it's a tool, but you can look at it just with your eye, and you can also put it in front of your camera lens, and you can take proper visual microscopy video and images. And this has created this massive database of research from all over the world, where people are sending in pictures of, you know, of the
microbes,
of bacteria, microbes, insects, fleas, mosquitoes, and it's contributing to this huge wealth of knowledge. But beyond that, I think what was amazing is the pictures of children learning about science and loving it, and being excited by seeing in water, in understanding that there are microbes in water and those microbes can make you sick on a much more visceral level than being told that such a thing exists, but you never get to see it.
I created about, like, almost like, if you think about Latin back in the day, it was a language of medicine and religion, and it made access to information difficult. So what technology and scaling it down to such a small thing, it democratizes it. It gives it to everybody. But if you're smart about it and how he's done it with an intention of collecting that information so that everybody's now behind one big cause, even if it's accidental.
Sure.
Which I think is amazing.
Yeah.
There was one, I believe he said that there was one teacher in India who...
Tamil was the language. That's
the second most used language in this research
on the community,
group
on the community.
Is Tamil, because he has personally... shown the foldoscope or trained the foldoscope of 96,000 students. I mean, it's incredible. Even know what, over how many years that, what rate he was working
here's
at.
Here's the thing, it's easy for him to do it with a simplified small device versus a massive microscope.
Spectron microscope or something, absolutely.
Yeah, that needs... needs all this power and all this understanding, and one person at a time can put their eyes on it versus this. Anybody can actually... I like that way of thinking of spreading the science everywhere as opposed to trying to spread scientists everywhere, because there's not too much of them. And maybe now you'll get more of them, with these kids being more...
Yeah, it's creating an affinity for science and a love for it and an understanding that it has value to them, which is, it's great.
Without the hurdle.
Yeah.
For those kids to have access to an actual microscope.
And for them it feels like a
take
toy.
What?
So they'll engage.
Yeah,
it,
but what would it take for them to actually get that? It would take... Yeah. They'll have to jump through all these hurdles in life and work and traveling, but they get the small device that you cut it out. What was it?
You pop it out.
And you assemble it, and all of a sudden you see something you've never seen before.
Yeah, it's a lot like those magic eye toys?
Yeah.
With the little circular slides.
There is a toy aspect to it, you're right.
It's a powerful part of it.
One of the things, sorry, just to pick up, he mentioned how these kids are actually getting clued up about the spread of lice, because they could actually see their own blood pumping through the lice through the amazing how they actually click and they start talking to each other about lice is a problem just because they can actually see it. It sticks in their mind. I think it's great. I think that's awesome.
Again, standing ovation.
Should be getting it. Don't get it. It was just nice project, move on.
I mean, and then briefly to touch on, I think we heaped a lot of praise on this guy. Briefly to touch on the ocean project, basically he just very insightfully said, he showed us a picture of, I think it was named Bodie McBoatface, but it was eventually renamed the Sir David Attenborough Research Vessel, and told us that the running costs of such a vessel are $40,000 to $50,000 a day. So he looked at the problem and figured out that there's 50,000 sailing yachts around the world crisscrossing the oceans, and why not turn each one of those sailors into a research scientist, collecting water samples and helping
these
to figure out how much plastic is in.
These are recreational sailors. They're not. It's not the marine.
Yeah.
It's not none of that.
Again, simplifying the science, spread the science around, simplifying it, make it easier for them just to do the samples, and then, but they really spread out.
There was in his presentation, there was a thing that jumped out at me as the most charming bit, and one of the sailors that he spoke about was the sailor story. The guy who was
the chicken guy. totally.
Chicken guy, get the chicken for the eggs. He capsized. It was one of the things.
Well, that's a frozen chicken, because they were showing aerial shots of this guy sailing through the Arctic or something like that. It's crazy. But the charm of that...
That was a Robert Wong-ish moment in the middle.
Yeah.
And then, and it's not through no... He's a brilliant man. Through no fault, it's not a bad thing that he then carried on talking about the science and the research. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to a presentation, that making an emotional connection, telling, just show us a picture of a chicken and everyone has a giggle and suddenly we're more engaged. I don't know if it's... Is it sad that we... need a puppy or a kitten to be thrown into a presentation?
No, we just
to pay
need
attention.
Something memorable. We need something to hold on to. We need an emotional connection.
Story.
Yeah, and that was a charming. It charmed us. And I don't want to harp.
Is that
too
not
much
the secret of his success? Sorry to cut you there. That he's not thinking in that terms. That's why he's been so successful.
It could be. I don't think he's unsuccessful. Don't get me wrong.
No. I'm talking about just presentation. Sorry. Yeah. I'm saying why he's so successful in him actually getting things done. Mm-hmm. He's done the microscope. He's done the sailors and doing all the without, I think, a great. Without this kind of presentation.
So maybe I'm about to jump on the soapbox here. But companies like Google, that's just trying to sell a product, where they should be, like, I think they should get involved with guys like Manu.
Yeah.
Because it is still cutting-edge tech, and there's so many values that align on that one, and I'd love to see them.
Yeah, it's data. He's literally collecting data, and their stated goal is to collate and collect every piece of data on Earth.
Yes.
I would love to see them collaborate.
Yeah.
And if I can step on the soapbox for a second, when it comes to, Wong's amazing. He's obviously a very genuine guy. But I think as the years go by, the specter of what Alphabet is and what Google is becoming a little bit harder to believe that they are trying to do no evil.
Yeah, but that's his job.
That's his job as the pitch man. And I don't know whether that's an explicit or an implicit thing, or whether he's... I don't get the impression that he's cynical about it. I don't know.
No, he's genuine.
He must be aware of this. I mean, the people who work at Google must be aware of the fact that there is a shadow being cast over by privacy issues and monopoly and agglomerating every new company they can, buying out all their competition, like Google, Facebook, and Amazon are becoming these three massive mega monopolies. And they can't claim to be... You know, the cute, like, Sergey and... who was the other guy? Anyway, the two founders...
I forgot his name.
The two founders of Google we're little upstart entrepreneurs. And we're all about, you know, grandpa's stories and all that kind of thing. I'm just finding it harder and harder to... Even though I almost cried as well. But at the end of it, you kind of walk out and go... It seems disingenuous to me to a degree now.
But that's you looking at as welcome to the world of Lucas cynicism. I like that. Yeah. If you were talking to John maybe 3 years ago, you wouldn't have seen it that way. So we can get very conspiratorial about things, but I think sometimes I get the feeling the more friendly and hey there guys, come and hug me, I'm a nice brand, the more your alarm bells should go on. But that's a personal thing.
The more salesy it is.
Well, the thing that the trick with the Google stuff was it didn't come across as salesy. It wasn't buy now. It was get you emotionally.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah, but okay. Manu accomplished quite a lot, right? Mm. We agree?
Yeah, yes. Of course.
Can you name me one brand you worked with?
No.
Yeah, he didn't mention
there's no money in it.
He didn't work with Shell, that contributor. He didn't work with anyone.
He must get funding from somewhere.
He didn't mention it, though.
No.
If he's in a... true academics, usually, they are running off of research grants of some kind.
We'd have to do more research on what company.
We don't know enough about it. But let's...
Yeah, but I think our cynicism is us thinking that if you have a big company that's worth billions behind, they would have accomplished this kind of thing that he did, but much bigger, maybe much bigger. And now the fact that they hasn't, and he's doing it, it's quite a brain jumble. It's making me think about a lot of things.
I think brands should look at what Manu's doing and go like, stop breaking the bank? And look at real solutions to real problems that are scalable. There are so many projects that brands do where they go like, they come up with something and it's like, look, we helped all of this township, but it's one township, and it was done for a campaign to win at Cannes.
Sure.
You know, or do something like advertising. Whereas I think the what these type of talks do, at least it informs. It forms a way of thinking.
Yeah.
And that I think that'll start. The more we meet people like Manu, the more that'll permeate.
He's a results man. Yeah. He's a results. I mean, I can imagine him talking to his team and like, no, we need... This needs to actually, but this result, not, I don't want, I don't care what the public thinks really of it. I actually want this to actually happen. Yeah. I think that's more the thing that that drives it.
Mm. But just to jump off the soapbox quickly.
Yeah. I wasn't on any box.
So yeah, you weren't on the box. I was.
No, yeah.
What did you guys think of Drift?
So Studio Drift, presenter there was Lonneke Gordien, I think another Dutch citizen. Let me have a quick look here. Studio Drift, founded by award-winning Dutch artists Lonneke Gordien and Ralph Nauta, believe that technology should be used to reawaken a sense of awe and wonder in humankind. As a multidisciplinary collective, Drift draws on new technologies to create their unique experiential artworks. And the experiential artwork that we are talking about here is an art exhibition installation with a giant floating cement block, which apparently they've been working on for, I think it was 16 years, she mentioned. But if you want to have a look at this yourself, just Google a YouTube search, floating cement block exhibit, and you'll find it. It's, she never explained how it works, and in no article that I researched did I find a proper explanation of how it works. It's quite simply a three-walled room with a giant cement block, and by giant, I'm saying the size of a car, floating in the air and moving very slowly around the space.
One of the criteria for it was it had to be big enough to fit a person inside.
Right.
So the minute I heard that and I saw the rectangle, I was thinking concrete coffin. it's a and then it leans to what is it? Egyptians.
Mm-hmm. Sarcophagi.
That's floating, and it's like this modern version of it. So that's the thing that I
wonder
kept
if some billionaire looked at that and thought, I want to get buried in that.
In a floating coffin.
Yeah, she said that she pitched the idea so many times, and then she said like there was conversations with certain people about it can't be done.
Yeah.
And then she just said
the dandelion lights they created, and now they're working on something where it's I think there's a tree that drops its seeds in Amsterdam at a certain time, and they're thinking about how to turn those little seeds into little LED lights as well to create a drifting a drift of seeds that can float in the wind.
So you just glazed over the dandelion light, really?
Yeah, which was gorgeous.
Absolutely, yeah.
That was quite a
thing. Yeah.
It was beautiful. They collect dandelion seeds and then, on a little LED light, attach the seeds. So it reconstitutes
with glue by hand.
And this is one of those I had seen this light before, but in a program of a collector who collects objects of desire for billionaires, basically.
Wow.
And this was one of the things that featured. And it is, have a look at a dandelion light from Drift Studio Drift.
The level of OCD is high with this.
That went into it is just ridiculous. And then it seems that they are one of the pioneers in drone technology and that swarm effect thing. Mm. So, and she spoke really nicely about how you have to feel it. So they looked at how starlings fly in swarms. Swarms? Yeah.
Yeah, it's a murmuration of starlings, I believe.
It's a murmuration.
I think so.
Cool. Another big word.
I'll look that up just to not embarrass myself. Okay, let's carry on.
But it's mesmerizing.
It's mesmerizing.
That's completely mesmerizing.
So once they started getting the algorithms right with, and they were working with Intel to get the swarm effect right. They were saying, okay, cool, it's working, but they're not feeling it. And I was like, oh, that's when from a creative point of view, when you're sitting in a room and you go in an edit or you talk to your show and you go, I'm not feeling it. It's the worst bit of feedback.
Especially to an engineer.
Yeah, especially to an engineer. So they sat there and they tried to figure it out until they could feel it. And you could see it in the footage of these drones that are lit at night, just swarming in patterns. And I think, to your point, it has to become mesmerizing. Feel that. It's not just a technical... Like I think Lady Gaga did a Super Bowl show, and they made the flag and stuff like that. I didn't feel it.
It was just like...
It's simply an impressive display of technology,
exactly.
Which the engineers will be happy with.
Yeah.
But they... I think music was key, and... they just had to finesse it.
Yeah.
They didn't just go, okay, well, we've got a swarm now, we're done. They had to keep on fine-tuning and really turning it into a piece of art.
Yeah, the feeling thing when it comes to technology, especially because you're reproducing something that's
natural,
that's, yeah, synthetic. So, for example, when you do, I'm going on my audio stuff, but if you try to reproduce audio, so in the audio world, like speaker systems, the highest level that you can get from a good speaker system is this moment where you forget that you're listening to speakers and you feel that you're right there in front of the person performing. That's the highest level. It doesn't sound like good speakers. The technology is gone. It disappears. And I think that's part of the feeling about it drifting, is that there's a part of you going like, it feels like it's organic.
Right. Yeah.
And that's like the hardest thing to get. Yeah. That's like the hardest thing to get from the technology, is to get an organic feel.
Sure. They also did this, I'm going to describe it as, imagine those long boats that people row with.
Yeah.
And it felt like a cathedral of sorts, with this row of lights that just kind of had like kind of a wing effect. And I was always like, that's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. It's not just lighting, it's this thing that moves in such an organic way. Mm. And again, it's very hard to describe it, but go and have a look at his stuff. And I think,
check out Studio Drift.
It's very interesting. Also, this leads me to their partner designers. I can't remember the guy's name.
No, but they were their designers, then they were in a relationship for 10 years, then out of a relationship. She talked about continuing to work.
The dynamic between the two personalities. She's messy, he's tidy.
Right.
They fight, they argue, then they find a middle ground, and then they come back to each other again. And I thought that was really nice, because it also leads to the architect couple that we, the Chinese architect couple.
That married couple.
Oh, if you like the drift stuff, check out Strand Pierce.
Oh, right, that kinetic sculpture.
It's organic, it's mechanical, it flows with the wind,
Neri and Hu, from Lyndon Neri and Rosanna Hu, award-winning Shanghai star architects. Do you want to move on to them?
Yeah. If you go, it just leads to them.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's have a look at their bio here quick. Neri and Hu are altering the built environment. Their work is reshaping Chinese visual identity while profoundly altering the built environment around the world. Formulas are anathema to multiple award-winning Shanghai-based architects Lyndon Neri and Rosanna Hu. Neri and Hu assert that trends are no longer relevant and customization and context are king. Asia's hottest architects run a multidisciplinary design practice with global reach spanning the built environment, creative direction, interiors, product design, and branding. Expect a philosophically and visually rich presentation.
They've been married
for 30 years and were very charming.
Very charming.
Oh, yeah, he was like a host.
Yeah.
He was great.
And clearly they didn't time their presentation very well, because about 10 minutes into it, he realized, we're going to be way late here.
Yeah,
they should have an architect in Daba. So we just have all these guys, all the architects talk.
What was awesome about this is literally this body of work that they could just kept on talking. Every piece was beautiful, and it had a backstory to it, and it wasn't just beauty for beauty's sake. They considered it. I always find it strange when someone says the hottest Asian designers,
star
that
architects.
Language doesn't do it justice.
Apply to them, absolutely.
It just goes contextual, fantastic.
Historically respected, nostalgic.
The designers, right?
In both interior, exterior, product design. I think they're multidisciplinary.
Because they were talking about how they step into architecture.
I think their title was interdisciplinary.
Yeah, but they are architects primarily.
Oh, wow.
Where do you start with their stuff? They started talking about context within China and about that people leaving villages and going to cities.
Yeah.
So there's a massive abandonment of these traditional sites. There were 300
villages per day. Going extinct in China.
It went from 3 million to 2 million.
Yeah, 3.6 to 2.6 in something like 5 years or something.
It's crazy.
Don't check our math on that, please.
So I think something that jumped out at me was the new Shanghai Theater, where they showed the context of the building.
Mm.
It was a theater that became a movie theater, and then went back to being a theater again. And at face value, when you look at it at this building from the street, it was very much nothing. It looks very blank. But once you just literally step off the sidewalk into it, it just opens up into this amazing space. Mixture of concrete and light and wood. And
they gave the entrance here to the public.
Yes. Because the entrance used to be on the sidewalk. So when you step into it now, there's this kind of outside foyer that happens to it. And with a kind of cathedral-like effect that goes into a
There's a giant skylight. It's an open-air skylight.
And you're not even inside yet. Yeah. You still have to go through the doors.
And it's beautiful enough that people will step from the sidewalk into this atrium and look up, and it's its own arresting piece that draws attention.
Yeah, usually you get that experience from stepping inside the building. You have to go through the entrance to have that awe.
Yeah.
Experience of having that kind of structure and that view when you step inside the building. The fact that it was just open to anybody. You didn't have to go in, watch a movie, anything. You just walk up. It was great.
To soapbox for a second about architect presentations, I often find, speaking as a wanky writer, I often find architects' rationalizations of design choices to be quite airy-fairy and tenuous. But the... to explain to anyone listening, the walls were on the interior of this theater were made of wood, slats and slats of wood, designed in such a way that they looked like a curtain. They looked like a stage curtain. And when he pointed it out in his presentation, I saw the connection, and I didn't immediately see it, but when he pointed it out, I immediately got it. And I thought, that is a brilliant design element to bring into a theater in a subtle, beautiful way. And it felt real to me. It didn't feel as kind of random as some of the architect post-rationalizations I've heard.
I think this is going to be one of the hardest things to discuss, because this is visual as all hell.
Sure.
Like, you can't, like, it's I was trying to explain an illustration. You have to go and see this stuff yourself.
Yeah.
And I've after this, sort of to sing the praises again, I felt exposed to something completely new.
Yeah.
That I, out of my reference, but they made it also so understandable when they spoke about traditions, the respect that they want to show certain areas,
the mix of Chinese modernism, and that the when they talk about the depopulation of villages and moving to urban spaces, and one of the key things that they presented was a hotel that was based on an incredibly old, rundown building, which they updated with modern touches and turned into, but respected the idea of, I think it's the alley, I can't remember what it's called, a straight alley building or something like that, where traditional Chinese residences kind of run in alleys, and everyone's quite open to each other. There's kind of a lack of privacy.
It was called the Vertical Lane Hotel.
Vertical Lane.
But it was called Vertical Lane House.
Right, right.
But it was a hotel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's... And I do think, knowing a couple of friends who have moved to and lived in China, the overall drive with China is modernism. It's this transformation that they're going through, like becoming this massive superpower, and new is better in general. But their approach is trying to maintain that sense of culture and heritage and build it into the modernism without just saying, oh no, we only make old-fashioned buildings. They kind of do a mix, which I love.
Yeah. Yeah, they wanted the connection. They didn't want the, let's say, the next generation to kind of forget the old. So they kind of wanted to preserve that, and so they preserved it in the architecture mixed with the modern. So the one that hotel that David Beckham stayed at, that had the what they referred they were referring to it as dilapidated.
Yeah.
But it had the modern touches. The parts that were added on were this pristine white, and the rest of it was this kind of rundown. But they made it look very beautiful.
Yeah.
And they had this funny story about his mom coming in and his mom asking, "Is it done?
Yeah. Is it finished yet?" And he said, "Yes." And she said, "Have they paid you in full?" "Yes." Then they're either stupid or you're a genius.
So good.
It's a great line.
So good.
And so just stories like that. And from a speaker point of view, it's those anecdotes that catch you. Yeah. I could see his mom. And
yesterday, the guy who spoke about his mom, he brought his mom on at the end, which was Bas Timmer. He kept on talking about how you know, he was working out of a small studio and he couldn't store all of the offcuts for the shelter suit, so he just had them shipped to his mom, and he kept kind of like almost with this rhythm mentioning his mom, and at the end of the presentation he brought her on, and it was just incredibly touching, and that's what created such like, well, part of what created such a massive emotional reaction from the audience. Well, that's something that's run true for all design endabas, all TEDx's, all Pichu Kuchas that I've attended, is that that presenting is a skill, and you can be as incredible at in your industry or sector as you can be, but if you can't convey that information, it makes it much harder to get a reaction.
In the world of personality, I think it's being real. It's really, really your mom. It's a real story. You can't make that story up. And I find it in all presentations that I've done over the years as well, is the minute you go like, you honestly yourself in those things, people will respond better. If you're honestly an asshole, then lean into that.
Sure.
So if you have a real story or something relatable, just people are looking for that connection.
When you say honesty, not just authentic, but also sharing, being vulnerable, sharing a story from yourself. Not because someone can honestly be boring, or they can be an introvert who is poor at communication. And at that point, I think that actually it's better for them to put a little bit of work into the presentation, to get feedback, to put on a little bit more of a show than you might as an authentic, just being you.
A couple of years ago, there was a lady who came to present. She worked for car manufacturers, and she did the interior of cars. She's a South African lady, but she was super nervous to speak, and you could feel it. And she, weirdly enough, even in her nervousness, it came across charming, because she was being quite honest about her nervousness.
Sure, yeah.
And in the end, people just kind of like wanted her
to
succeed.
You wanted to succeed, yeah.
I want her to succeed.
Absolutely.
I think the approach of the audience in these cases as well, they actually all want these people to do well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a shortcut to getting the audience on your side, is to stand up and say, I'm really nervous right now, and I'm, you know, everyone wants to help.
Mm. Yeah, what connected me with Neri and her husband was about, I don't know which was which, was with architecture, about how it's artwork and it invokes emotion. So what I liked about the way he was speaking and giving these little stories was about how human he was, as opposed to being this elusive genius that you don't see, and he creates these big things and he says five words and people stand and applaud and he just wears black the whole day. He was giving the story he gave of the billionaire that built the house with the glass and the bathroom, and then at the end he died and the wife came and the wife
and
passed.
He built it in secret without his wife knowing possibly then, for some shenanigans,
and then
when he died,
response,
she showed up and said, why did he build this, and
how can I forget that building?
And he said, he was making it as a secret for you.
It's a gift. It was a secret gift. It was amazing.
Great little story.
All the small kind of things he did that made us laugh. Made me connect more with him doing what he does, that he's about feeling and connection as opposed to just the stale. Because look, a lot of architects get that stereotype.
Yes. Yeah, I think there's that. It's kind of like having a premium brand. It's creating this aura of mystery and intrigue and elitism that attracts, high-paying clients.
He spoke about problems he had, like big problems and expectations. Rounding off.
I feel like we've missed so many speakers, but I think it's just the guys that stood out to us.
Everybody was great, though.
It was a very good day. It's not taking away from the other speakers. These were just things we covered. Yeah. We could spend hours and
just
hours and
timeless,
hours.
As a little roundup, though, we don't want to spend a bunch of hours talking about some often very largely visual things. So do pop onto designdava.com, check out their Instagram page. They were posting continuously throughout the day. Stories as well, probably with clips from their presentations. So before those disappear, go check them out. If they're not going to highlight them, then this will be you've got 20 hours to do so. We're looking forward to day 3. I think Design and Dharma takes a lot out of you. I think we were, by the end of the afternoon, starting to feel a little bit of fatigue. And traditionally, by the end of Friday, I'm usually pretty destroyed.
Yeah. but also traditionally the last day is the best day.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So yeah, looking forward to that.
Me too. Yeah. I'm enjoying it so far.
Great. Yeah. Thanks very much for the roundup, guys. Let's go and get some dinner, have a rest, and reconvene in the morning. I hope you guys enjoyed this, and stay tuned for more tomorrow.